Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in today. This is Red Ice TV. If you're listening in the radio archive, do know that there is a video version of this program available at redice.tv and, of course, on our YouTube channel as well. So do make sure that you subscribe. We have Jay Dyer with us today from Jay's Analysis back on the show to tackle the issue of the removal of General Michael Flynn. This came in the form of his own resignation. Something that, frankly, Trump shouldn't have accepted, in my view. But there's been tremendous buzz around this issue, and of course, much behind the scenes that is going on, behind this case that we're not being told. It has to do with foreign policy. It has to do with America's stance on Russia, obviously, and the demonstration of power, of basically who it is that is in charge, despite the fact that Trump, a wild card in the deck, if you will, managed to get in as president. The establishment has kind of pointed to the Logan Act, interestingly enough, as a reason for why Flynn was, or at least should have been, removed. This is something, of course, the Logan Act that most politicians and presidents break on, if not even on a weekly basis by now, getting kickbacks from other governments, taking orders from foreign interests and this kind of stuff. Ultimately, my take is that Flynn didn't do anything wrong. He spoke with a Russian ambassador in Washington, D.C., and whether or not he forgot to tell Vice President, Mike Pence, that's another issue, I think. But Jay, tell us what's going on here and why there's been such immense controversy surrounding this this issue.
Well, it represents the interior battle within the deep state that we've seen going on for probably a long time, but most clearly manifested in the recent presidential election. So the election of Trump represents at least one side of the deep state. I think you could argue that perhaps is not as insane, perhaps not as fiercely global. They would like to, probably for many cases, business interests. They're not happy with things like Obamacare, right? I mean, this has done a lot of damage to industry and to medium to smaller size companies in the U.S. And so I have to think that not everybody is on board with globalism, even in the power structure. So I think that they aided and they chose a candidate who they felt would be more amenable to their interests. And so what we've actually been seeing is this kind of internal struggle that's playing out over time throughout this presidential campaign, interestingly. And so we are seeing a real resurgence of ideas that are flawed in themselves. I mean, Americanism, in my view, is a flawed philosophy. But I think that what we're seeing is people trying to put a halt on this madness of what is accurately called globalism. I mean, they ironically sit here and tell us that there's no such thing as globalism in the very publications that tout globalism. So, I mean, they're running nonstop Orwellian doublespeak psyops. Yeah, and we'll get to that, these foreign policy articles here in a minute that are great. But what we see with Flynn, I think, is a situation where somebody who tended to speak in neocon terms quite often. In fact, he supported the U.S. operation in Kiev to put in Yatsenyuk and then Poroshenko. So it probably looked as if this guy was going to be something of a neocon. And then we're supposed to believe that somehow he's tied into the Russians. What I think that this is really just to feed into this completely concocted, made up, nonsensical scenario by factions such as Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the Clintons, the Clinton Foundation, and their arms of the CIA and the NSA that do not like Trump. And so you have that big faction that wants to charge forward with the globalism. And what we mean by the globalism there is just more of the Soros so-called democracy, more of this nonsense through the NGOs and foundations that you and I talked about last time, furthering that narrative in all these other countries, working actually, as we've seen, hand in hand with the State Department, right? Victoria Nuland and the Soros Foundation working together in these other countries to further Washington's foreign policy, which is just the foreign policy of, as we said, these globalist interests, Wall Street, right? Saudi Arabia, Clinton Foundation, all of these entities that I think are the biggest juggernaut, the main danger. And so this ousting is a kind of mini coup, if you will, to, I think, disrupt what's going on that's positive in the Trump administration to rein it back under the umbrella of the neocons.
You know, I know that there's some in the administration now that, you know, maybe people from our perspective more or less wouldn't be that happy with. You know, there's some ex-Goldman Sachs people in there, you know, like Mnuchin, etc. But I find it interesting that it seems that foreign policy has been the most important issue to them. In other words, here is the first guy they really take out and topple, because foreign policy, that must be to them the number one issue, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's why I saw Trump as at least the most hopeful candidate in terms of altering the foreign policy. That's at least what he campaigned on. We all know that. And the unfortunate things that we've seen this week, I'm hoping can be overcome. Hopefully they're just sort of road bumps. We've actually seen the Trump administration and his people be very crafty. So they're actually very good at baiting, laying traps for the opponents. And I don't think that what we see with this Flynn situation is basically the Empire Strikes Back. Okay, so you do have a real opposition within the deep state, and this is the deep state in its most powerful sense. The neoconservatives, and we can include the Clintons and their crew, Soros and that crew, they're all under this same umbrella, and they're striking back. That's what we're looking at right here.
Very good. So obviously there's a lot of tentacles to what happened and how they managed to actually outmaneuver him. The biggest surprise to me, Jay, was why did Trump accept the resignation? So it was almost to me that something else was going on, that they almost had something on Flynn, which got him to actually say, all right, that's it, I'm out then. Because why would it be such a big deal of speaking with an ambassador in Washington, D.C.? This is, politicians do this on a daily basis, right?
Yeah, well, they're probably showing their hand in terms of what they're going to try to construct with this phony Russian narrative. So they've been trying for a long time to concoct this made-up story that the Trump is a Russian agent, and that the Russians hacked the DNC and they hacked the elections and all this stuff, all of which is complete nonsense and totally made up. And so they're able to make stories, to make narratives out of things that are absolutely normal procedure, right? Heads of state talking to ambassadors. Give me a break. I mean, like you mentioned the Logan Act. Nobody cared about the Logan Act when Hillary and Obama were meeting at Bilderberg.
Right, exactly. Or taking money from Chinese business people. You know, all this happens all the time. Or even listening to Israeli interests, all this kind of stuff.
Exactly. No one was concerned with all the money that China and Saudi Arabia gave to Hillary.
That's right.
So this just represents another attempt, another, as you said, tentacle, another means by which the deep state, the real global power structure, is attempting to rein any attempt at opposition in the executive branch back under the neocon umbrella. And mainly, as you said, mainly to continue all these foreign policy ventures, because the power structure is Raytheon, Boeing, these kinds of people, right? The big oil companies. They're behind a lot of this stuff. And, you know, these are the people involved in Obamacare, right? They're the ones exempt from it. It's all these giant multinationals who don't have any interests that align up with people or ethnic groups' interests. These are all tools. These are all fodder, cannon fodder for global multinationals to basically ruin areas, create new markets, and then move into those markets. And that's what regime changes are really about in the long run.
Is this a coup? I mean, is this a beginning initial step? They were talking a while back about this. There was articles coming out, you know, well, this is how a coup would look, and, you know, it's kind of normal, and it would be a contingency government in its place for a while, and then, you know, this would happen. They were like explaining it, and supposedly these were some military insiders talking in these kinds of terms. Is this, do you think, just the initial step of what they're going to attempt to do? Are we going to see more of Flynn resignations, etc.?
That's very possible. It's very difficult. Everybody's having a hard time figuring out what the next move is. And I think that's part of the success of the craftiness and the wiliness of Trump and his crew, is that he's keeping everyone guessing, and mainly the enemies. I thought that if you saw the press conference yesterday, that was Trump striking back at the deep state, maneuvering to get rid of Flynn. And again, Flynn's not perfect. He's not that great. But This was seen to eventually be not a great move in terms of Russian relations. And so there was the idea that Flynn would maybe maneuver things into a positive detente situation with Russia. And so that is not what any of these neocons or the Clintonites or the Soros types want. They want a total confrontation. They want the destruction, ultimately, again, of Russia. It's not about American interests. It's not about keeping America safe. It's about the countries that, as the globalists themselves have admitted many times in white papers, even in their tweets, Carl Bildt, right? He's worried about Russia and its ethnic group and its religion and its nationalism. So that's what this is really about. Make no mistake about it. This is why they didn't like Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia, right? It's because regardless of what you think of those religions or those people groups, from the perspective of globalism, all of that has to be wiped out. And in fact, as many of the globalist white papers that I have printed out here before me in this giant stack, I feel like Alex Jones or something here. These stacks of articles, they say that the problem is that we are not creating enough of a monoculture. This piece out of Foreign Policy, right? It actually says that. It says that the purpose of globalism, right? Globalism is the victory of Western ideals. The purpose is to create a homogenous market, a mono market, right? Now, you can't do that if people have firewalls and existing allegiances, right? If people have allegiances to religion or to their people or to their group or their ethnic community, local allegiances, local cultures, right? That's difficult if you're McDonald's, right?
Correct.
you want so, and I'm not just saying it's all McDonald's, but you know what I'm saying. It's all of these things. It's as this author says, the good globalism, he says, promotes liberalism across the globe. And he says that democratic countries tend over time, fortunately, he says, to hold to all of the same ideas. And what he means by that, of course, is the free market, global, capitalist, liberal, democratic structure, right? In other words, Pepsi and Coke. So that's what this is about in the big scale, right? And then what we're seeing in the small scale and why people have such a problem, and why I, for example, would prefer a Trump to a Ron Paul. Ron Paul wants open borders. That's crazy, right? At least Trump has the rhetoric of at least one executive order attempt, right, at building the wall and stopping open borders, because he realizes that from a business perspective, this really only benefits, you know, the 1% of the 1% in terms of multinationals. That's why the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, all these groups have always been for open borders. In fact, what does this guy say? This guy says at the end of this article, and I'm not going to name him by name because I don't want to support his work, but he says at the end of his foreign policy article, the great hope immigration, right? Immigrants are the hope, right, to the liberal world order. Wow. So that's why we see Peter Sutherland, head of the UN migration chief, right? And as you've pointed out many times, the guy who, the banker who goes on the BBC and says this is all to destroy existing cultures and nation states.
That's right. Absolutely extraordinary. You know, if we look at these kinds of articles. I also enjoy the fact that they put globalism in quotes, like it isn't really a thing. But now when we're on the topic, it turns out, of course, that those values that you call globalism, that's really what we wanted to bring you all this time anyway. They're just finally opening up about this, and it's finally just right out in the open for people to read it and to see it for themselves.
Just think about this. This article from the week, this liberal article, talking about America spies anonymously taking down Michael Flynn. And he says this is deeply worrying. Now, this guy goes on to talk about the deep state. Right now, he's not a Trump supporter, but he's worried about the deep state. Could you imagine 5 years ago? I know you and I both have followed alternative independent media for at least a decade or more. Could you imagine even 5 years ago, a giant liberal publication talking about the deep state?
It's amazing.
No. So this alone is a victory. This is good news right here.
Yes. Absolutely.
Even these mind bomb left zombies are having to talk about the deep state. which I thought didn't exist. Now it does. Exactly.
They've been denying it for 10 years. We were crazy conspiracy theorists for believing this kind of stuff. And now they wheel it out like, well, actually, it's the greatest thing ever because this is liberal democracy and this is what we're going to do to you. So just if we stick on Flynn there for a moment, a little bit more. I know that his son was tweeting about Pizzagate and this kind of stuff. There is many tentacles here of why they would want to maybe go after him or take him down or sever some of his associations. But do you think that ultimately those things to the side, this is about Russia? Is that their primary worrying element in this equation?
Yes. And you see that the think tanks and the left and the so-called ideologues have been talking about this for a long time. Even going back to the 90s, they've been talking about the danger that a resurgent Russia and nationalism and homogeneity of cultures could pose to the liberal world order, as they keep calling it. As you know, I did an entire lecture series on the totality of tragedy and hope. And in fact, what Dr. Quigley says in that whole book, that massive tome, is that the hope of the 20th century and the millennia to come is the liberal world order. That's the whole point of that book, is that the market and the liberal FDR, you know, four freedoms and all this kind of propaganda nonsense, that's the great hope of the world. And so, yes, we had to have all these giant world wars to bring that freedom. But don't worry, one day it's just like the communists, right? The socialists and the Marxists are always saying, well, we just haven't had the actual real version of it yet, but it's coming. Don't worry, I promise. We're going to get the real communism one day. Well, guess what? The left, the democratic capitalist progressives say the exact same thing.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, you know, as we've talked about, they do this, out of fear that millions of people are going to be killed and murdered, right? They want to defend themselves against nationalism because this led to all these world wars, supposedly, right? So in their equation is kind of weaved into this idea of sacrifice. You have to, well, you know, you have to kind of crack a few eggs to make an omelet, because in the wake of their vision, of their delusion, they're not only destroying nations, they are causing tremendous amount of upheaval and this multicultural view. I mean, look at what's happening in France right now, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, with their multicultural idea, this is it.
Yeah, actually, I linked to some censored videos in one of the last few articles I did out of France from LiveLeak that showed the real situation of the migrants, which was, it was like worse than East St. Louis ghetto. It looks terrible.
Yeah, it's horrible.
And so that's by design. Now, you look at this other piece here, for example, that answers your question, called The Collapse of the Liberal Order, that they wrote back in June of 2016 when Trump announced his candidacy and when he started talking about Americanism and this kind of stuff and not globalism. And what they were saying in The Collapse of the Liberal World Order was that we have come to the end of history. So these people actually believe this Francis Fukuyama narrative that this is the end of all history, right? And eschatology always has played some kind of mystical myth in Marxism and liberalism, and right, they're all going to bring this new golden age and stuff like that, which they actually constantly critique the right of, right? They always say the right's going to promise all this stuff. You know, for example, they'll critique the right about religious views, right? And, oh, you believe in these far-off, far-flung utopias and new eternal life or something like this.
Fairy tales and, yeah.
The fairy tales. Yeah. Everything they're talking about is a fairy tale. This is what they talk about, right? Oh, we're going to bring the liberal borderless world will come one day, and then we'll all get along once we've erased everybody's distinctions. That's right. Once we get rid of all the genders and the boys and the girls and the blacks and the whites, and once we get rid of all that, I promise you, just believe me, we'll have happiness and we'll have utopia. And, you know, it'll be like the end of the Matrix trilogy, where it's like everybody's happy and there's the black guys and the white guys and everybody's the same and we're all one. And all right. I was just watching the Matrix the other day, and I was laughing at the end of that, where it's like they had to create a computer simulation of the utopia at the very end of the trilogy, where finally everybody's going
with the rainbows and everything,
with
right?
With the rainbow, rainbow coalition. Yeah. And one of these guys in this article actually talks about this. He says that the right wing is afraid of our rainbow coalition.
Yeah, we are. We don't want it.
Yeah, because we see the destruction of it, and it's destructive. And so that's why the World Economic Forum, that's why the Institute for Strategic Studies, that's why foreign policy, that's why the CFR. This is all I've done the past few weeks is read these white papers, and this is what they're talking about. They're talking about what they're afraid of and the dangers that they see. And when they talk about why the, quote, international community, we're already under a global government, by the way, right? The post-war, right, post-Soviet Cold War era global order of Americanism. They're worried about that falling because America, they say, is the engine of globalism and the global democratic order.
Interesting. Yeah. And so, of course, that's why America is the prize, and that's why it's so important. So this thing with Trump has, I mean, it must have been, it must be a such a an immense just backstep for them, is taking the wheel, so to speak, is something which has set them back. I don't know how long, to be honest, but this is their desperate attempt at trying to regain and maintain control again. And the question, of course, is, as you previously said, what happens next? What's the next maneuver? How do they proceed from here? And it's going to be very interesting to see if there's any proposals of who's going to replace Flynn. Have you heard anything about that yet?
No, I don't know on that, but it does represent a backstep and a problem. Otherwise, I mean, if you think about it, just the stuff that Trump talks about, there have been many mainstream articles that note that when he talks about these things, when he tweets about these things, it costs a lot of these, especially the military industrial complex, it costs them money. So his campaigning and then his winning the election cost like Raytheon and Boeing tremendous amounts of money because they were worried about the plans that they had based on Hillary winning, right? And who Hillary was going to divvy up the countries that she was going to destroy to these various corporations.
You're saying that they're planning ahead of time what they're going to do, which countries next, right? Which war we're going to proceed with. And so, ergo, this means loss and revenue loss for these the military industrial complex.
Absolutely. They write articles talking about revenue loss just based on the talking and the rhetoric. So Trump's win cost a lot of people a lot of money.
Yeah.
I mean, look at all the money that was poured into Hillary, you know.
Yeah,
that's amazing. Hundreds of millions of dollars. So
Trump's got to watch out. Assassinations. Anything is on the table at this point, right?
Well, I guess anything is possible, but I think that what we're watching is the main strategy that they're going to keep using. They're going to keep trying to implode from within. And I think that the real goal of the establishment is to make Trump appear so preposterous and so crazy, which is why they're having this, you know, media propaganda spin 24/7 with the articles coming out. And you can hardly even tell what's true. Like, you have to really sift through, and because they'll take anything. I saw some article talking about Trump's a dictator because he made Chris Christie eat meatloaf at a dinner. I mean, this is what constitutes mainstream news, right?
They're talking about his mental health now, right? That somehow.
And they're talking about, right. So they're throwing out all of these stories. By the way, I figured Chris Christie would eat the meatloaf and everything else at the dinner, but I don't know why he'd have to be forced just to eat the meatloaf. But
his bag of M&M's in a box. Yeah. Remember that debate? Anyway, so this is why they're. I wonder if they're trying to legitimize basically, like, you know, again, if we topple Trump, we're doing that because he's crazy and he shouldn't really be president, right? We have to, someone has to come in here. The fun time is over. Let the real, you know, big boys take over at this point, right?
Well, that's why Soros is putting all of this money, and he talked about it right after Trump won. He was going to double up the money. That's why suddenly you know what Antifa is. Who knew what Antifa was 2 years ago? I know that you guys did videos exposing Antifa and then like the split between the lesbian Antifa and the anarchists.
Yeah.
But now everybody knows what Antifa is because suddenly there are these giant blocks of black bloc Antifa anarchist protesters who seem to show up when Milo or Gavin McInnes is going to talk somewhere. Well, who the heck are where are these Antifa people? Well, I guarantee you it's coming from this kind of money that's in the background that's suddenly helping them pop up everywhere. I mean, this is what we were reading months ago that the Soros groups were going to, I think he had money and connections to some 50 groups involved in, for example, the Women's March.
Yes. Amazing.
56 partner organizations, right? The National Resource Defense Council, Planned Parenthood, Women's blah, 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 Move On, blah, 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 Soros, blah, blah, blah. Exactly. So that's also, I would presume, where the Antifa and Black Bloc are suddenly now household names, I guess. They're this giant organization. And we're supposed to believe that this is a huge movement of people against Trump. When it's not, that's precisely the point of you put the money into the bust around fake protesters and fake anarchy groups with provocateurs in there. They cause the havoc and throw cocktails and bust out windows and pull down their pants and crap on the street, which that one woman actually did. And then that gets the media attention. And then the media creates the impression that there's this giant crowd, you know, of masses of people that are ready to topple Trump.
So, you know, there was another story revealing that it was Jack Dorsey, maybe the Twitter CEO, talking about this, that yes. Somehow there is an American Spring that's happening right now. And as we know, if we go back to the Arab Spring, completely manufactured, completely controlled, top down. I just see the same fingerprints of what's happening in America right now with all this left wing violence, with very coordinated and organized events, as we've seen in previous Trump events. There was buses. They're busing, shipping in people. They're paying people. They're even, I think there was Craigslist ads, actually, a while ago, like 50, was it 50 bucks an hour, I think it was? Something remarkable like that.
I saw once for 15. There may have been 50, but...
maybe it was 15. Anyway, they got their minimum wage right there, but the new top minimum wage.
Yeah, I guess that's the new economy, is the bust around protester economy.
It's going to be hugely successful.
Join the Black Bloc, and do you get Obamacare if you join the Black Bloc? I don't know. But and what's funny about the Twitter thing is Twitter is gamed. I see it myself. This guy, CEO, talks about it in an article that they can control the narrative, and they're basically injecting themselves into the discussion of America. And they said that previously America's discourse didn't matter, but now, because of Twitter, everything that Twitter puts to the top of the news stories suddenly makes it matter, right? So and this is ridiculous, because when I get on Twitter and I look at what the top stories are, it's like BuzzFeed type stuff of, you know, quote, heartwarming. Did you see what happened? You won't believe what happened to this transgender puppy. You know what I mean? It's like, if you read the story about the transgender puppy, it's going to change your heart, and you're going to suddenly love and understand. That's what I see at the top of Twitter.
Yeah.
Right. As well as like how I saw one. It's Black Lives Matter is always at the top of Twitter. And then how bad Trump is and how Trump's going to send people door to door. And that was one Twitter today, was the National Guard's going to come door to door and take away anybody that doesn't have their papers or something, which was a fake story, by the way.
Yeah, of course.
And so, again, I think that's why Trump was striking back, at that press conference, saying this is all fake. Very fake. Very fake. All very fake. You're all fake. You, not you. You, no, shut up. Not you. But anyway, so yeah, that's important, because Twitter played a central role, even as that guy says, in the Arab Spring, right? The hashtag revolutions, which last time I was on with you, we talked about Soros, NGOs, and how this has been studied for years at the academic RAND Corporation level, the swarming model, right? Goes all the way back to the 60s and 70s, where they were doing the student riots, student protesting. This is all done from a total military strategy standpoint to give the impression of all of this discontent and unrest, which is all manufactured. And then that is intended to influence the rest of the population to get on board with all the unrest.
Yeah, exactly. It's manipulating, a perception and making it seem as a certain thing. And this is what's happening. And then more people get aboard. And I'm certain that there's many useful idiots, as, Lenin used to call them, part of these groups. Now they're thinking they're doing something, because let's talk about the narrative that they've used to shape around Trump here now as well. The fact, as you say, there's now teams of people going around knocking door or breaking in doors, hauling people away. It's basically turning into Nazi Germany again, right? It's fascism, fascism, fascism everywhere we look now. Trump literally is the new Hitler. And if you don't go out on the streets and like defend yourself against this, your family are going to be put in camps next. I mean, this is almost how absurd it is now.
Yeah, I remember Hitler had all those casinos, right? That's how Hitler got to power, was a bunch of casinos. And then I think he had some pageants. He ran the German pageant network syndicate. And then he came to power, and then he rounded up and killed only Jews.
The Weimar trans pageant, yeah.
Yes,
it's retarded.
So much similarity between a billionaire capitalist, TV star, Trump, and Adolf Hitler, right? they're mirrors, exactly the same. This is how stupid this is, right? And of course, as we've noted many times, they count on the idiocy of the public, because, you know, they were saying this exact same thing with Putin. Putin is a Hitler, even though Russians fought Germans, right?
That doesn't matter.
None of that matters. Anybody who is a male, a white male especially, patriarchal, maybe they got a little mojo, maybe they're kind of badass in some degree, then they just got to be a fascist. They've got to be Hitler. And that's why the left for a long time has expanded the elasticity of fascism to mean, as we've said, anything they don't like.
That is correct.
It has nothing to do with its actual historic meaning or Mussolini's essays explaining what, you know, corporatism / fascism is. Nothing to do with that. It just means anything to do with like objective facts, anything to do with objective studies, anything to do with real research, truth, anything healthy, anything organic. All of that is classed under the helpful elasticity of fascism.
I don't think there's any other term that's been more misused and abused, at least not now in the last 10 years or so. But you had actually an article on this. It was very interesting. I think it was written by Umberto Eco. Tell us about this a little bit, because this is a breakdown. Because usually, Jay, we get a very, very poor definition of fascism. People don't really know. They think it means just mass murder. If you want to mass murder people, you're a fascist. But then there's all these other things compiled into that as well. But tell us a bit what he wrote about in this fascism piece.
Right. So one of the things that me and my buddies, Daniel Spaulding, Daniel sent me this article, and we've talked about and critiqued this idea of what the left does, or what progressives so-called have tried to do for a long, long time, is to, especially since World War II, basically, is to label anything healthy or anything that they don't like as, quote, fascism. And so it just becomes this political bantered about term with absolutely no meaning whatsoever. And then it relies on the ignorance of the people that hear it, that assume that, fascism equals, Jews in ovens. That's what was bad. And so I don't like people in ovens. So I guess I'm against the fascists, and whatever you say is a fascist is a fascist. But in fact, Eco himself, this famous progressive and semiotician philosopher who I've cited many times in my works and books and articles, he actually wrote this somewhat famous essay lining out for you. He's going to help you, give you the 14 points of fascism. And now, you thought perhaps, if you were educated out there, that fascism was a historical phenomenon, maybe related to Mussolini and what he wrote about, or Franco or something like this. No. You see, Urfascism is the real, perennial, eternal enemy of anybody who's a real Democrat and a real liberal, right? So what is Urfascism? Well, what we discover is that, number one, it's anybody who believes in, quote, tradition. Do you believe in a tradition of any kind, in the sense that maybe it's healthy to pass on what you were raised with or what you believe? Well, if you're Umberto Eco, no, that is a fascist. Red flag number one. Uh-oh, we're going to have to mark you down here on our clipboard. You might be a fascist. Think like a crappy version with Jeff.
If you got tradition, you might be a fascist,
right? Like a Jeff Foxworthy version of this,
right?
Kidding. You're anti-modern, he says. Number two, anti-modern. in that you do not accept rational scientific critique. Well, that just presumes that modern scientism is in fact rational, but it may not actually be. And in fact, I make many arguments that if you don't like the Enlightenment and the French Revolution, 1789, 1776, if you don't like the Masonic revolutions, you might be a fascist.
There you go.
Red flag number three. Now this is where it gets really, they get worse and worse and worse and worse. Number three, bare action. A fascist has no belief in what he does. He just does action for action. It's bare action. Now, excuse me. I'm pretty sure that that's the characteristic of the Antifa and the people that are anti-Trump. Right.
Yeah.
When you go to the university, they teach you to do protest and action for action's sake, praxis. That's a Marxist thing. That's not a, quote, fascist thing. So he's totally incorrect there. Number four is that you don't believe in analytical criticism. You argue that, now what's funny is that this guy argues for total relativism, right, which is the most irrational, non-analytic position imaginable.
Right, exactly.
But if you believe that there's objective truths or logic, you might be a fascist.
See, that's interesting, you know, because I've started to hear that more and more, that it, if it's like, if you see meaning, or even I heard it recently, if you're opinionated, yeah. These were actually red flags. They talked about, I believe this was in the context of the shooter in, was it Quebec, the mosque, right? They talked about the fact that he was allegedly opinionated, meaning if you have any strong opinions whatsoever, if you have any kind of convictions, and if you believe that you might be right without having this, as you said, Jay, constantly go back to this moral relativistic position that, well, we can't really know, or there's no such thing as good and bad. If you don't have that, that's an early warning sign that you might go shoot up a mosque and you're an evil right winger.
Yeah, and the funniest part about that is that the most fascistic people are the ones who dominate you with relativism. If you don't believe in their relativism, they're ready to stamp a boot on your face for all eternity. They're the most tyrannical. That's the irony.
They are. They're authoritarian while they're complaining on authoritarianism. It's amazing.
It's the most double-minded, nonsensical thing.
Yeah.
So anyway, he goes on to say, obviously, if you have any concern for a people group that you're a part of, then that's racist.
Of course.
You might be a fascist.
Yep.
Now he goes on to say that if you believe in conspiracies, if there are giant conspiracies, you might be a fascist. Guess what? In this essay, Umberto Eco argues for a giant international fascist conspiracy. So I guess by his own definition, he's a fascist. See, he violates every one of these, is what's so ironic about this. But you see that the left position is absolutely nothing about being coherent and consistent.
Well, but he knows that he's morally correct, you see. So it doesn't matter. Facts doesn't matter. Reality doesn't matter. He's morally correct, so they see it fit to do whatever they want, right? I've heard that too. They actually see persecution, if you will, of people who take a more right position, or those who are, you know, slightly to the right of, let's say, Bernie Sanders or something. They can literally be violently targeted because that's an act of self-defense. I've literally heard that.
Henrik, you're crazy. You need to adopt socialism. That's the only way out. Hillary Clinton is awful. Now she's great.
That's pretty good. I like that.
That's my Bernie. That's on the spot Bernie there.
Yeah.
But here's the funny thing, too, that Eco notes. He says that the fascists are humiliated by wealth. They're jealous of all the other people's money out there. Now, that's funny because that's actually the communist Marxist socialist principle.
Right.
Of wanting other people's wealth. So once again, Eco fails on his own grounds. Then he goes on to talk about how the fascists are inconsistent because in their news articles and in their propaganda, they'll at the same time attack the enemy and say that the enemy is weak and we could, if we just discovered our will, we could dominate them. But the enemy is so powerful and so strong that they could at any time crush us. And so therefore, the fascists and their propaganda are inconsistent. However, isn't that funny? Because as Nina points out many times in her arguments with all of these mainstream media, Nina Kuprianova, all these mainstream media pundits, they consistently say Russia is on the verge of collapse, yet they're so powerful and they're such an imperium that they hacked our elections and they're going to take over. That is actually the democratic. Amazing. Yeah, that's the democratic strategy. So every one of these points, right? he goes on to say, Urofascism is the belief that life is eternal struggle. So his own fucking essay is eternal struggle.
Right, exactly. it's a projection, obviously, Jay. I mean, I feel sometimes that fascism is this perfect kind of boogeyman that mm-hmm. you can kind of shape it into whatever you need at that specific moment and time to use it as your, you know, token enemy so that you can dictate, you know, behavior, foreign policy, you know, human interaction, social, you know, order and these kinds of things. So it has become this malleable, just whatever you want it to be at that moment kind of threat, right?
Well, here's the best part. This is the most glaring nonsense that makes your point. He goes on to talk about that the fascists have the problem of they have sex, all these sex problems. They're all a bunch of sex perverts with sex problems. Now, wait a minute. It's not fascists that are promoting bestiality. It's not fascists that are promoting 60 different genders in Germany. It's not the fascists that are promoting pedophilia.
No.
Is it?
No.
No. So amazing. Who has the sex problems? By the way, if you're a moral relativist, how are you going to critique anybody else on sex problems? That doesn't make any sense.
Oh, man.
So anyway, he goes on and on and on. And basically what you learn is that this is just a giant Orwellian exercise in propaganda. And in fact, you know, he says that fascists are Orwellian. And he tries to roll in George Orwell, Eric Blair here. The irony is that Orwell was talking about Fabian socialism, the very thing that Echo is kind of talking about here.
Right.
So it's a bunch of lies. Everything's relativized. Everything's nonsense. And what you realize is that exactly as you said, the whole thing is just an exercise in a way to demonize an opponent with a bunch of word salad, word garbage that is not based on anything coherent, rational, or objective and factual.
Yeah, point 14 mentions Newspeak, right? And going into Orwell without then reflecting on the doublethink issue, right? Of these contradictions that we talked about before, that it's like, you know, it doesn't matter how you view the external world, and you can just project this upon others when you're actually dealing with these issues yourself. I know that this piece is a bit, you know, it was written back in 1995. It's a bit older, but as we go through it, it almost feels that has completely kind of manifested itself. And this is the type of left, liberal, progressive enemy that we're facing now who actually think like this. How influential was he to dictate some of these rules, do you think?
I think the essay is pretty famous. It's pretty well known. And in fact, he talks about dangers of Russia early on in this essay. And the reason he sees Russia as a problem is that anywhere that you could have these principles of homogeneity, of traditional culture, of religion, of organic thought and locality, all of these things are dangers to modern liberal order. And that is, now again, that's 1995. And then when I go and I read the think tanks and the white papers and what they're saying now in 2017, Putinism, populism, and the defense of liberal democracy out of the Institute for Strategic Services, they say the exact same thing as Echo in 1995, right? I mean, this woman goes on to say, with the ousting of Yeltsin and putting these oligarchs in prison, we got to worry about Russia. Russia might turn into something that's not a liberal democracy. And if we don't adhere to Hannah Arendt, if we don't adhere to all of these, which, by the way, you would think that liberalism is populism. You would think.
Right, exactly.
Not to them, right? Because what we see is that, contrary to Echo in his piece, they're actually a liberal elite that despise people.
Absolutely, right? Yeah. They know better than everyone, you know.
They see themselves as a privileged, quote, individual, supposedly, right? They're supposed to be all about individual liberties. And so, therefore, they implicitly hate other people groups, and ultimately hate humanity and probably themselves as well. And so that's why, for them, they ironically are not populist.
Right? No, so they're not. They despise it.
This backs up the traditional argument of Plato that democracy has always been a tool of moneyed oligarchy. And that's because it always appeals to base desires. has no concern or attachment to principles, to things that might be objective. It only has an attachment to who can control the masses' base desires the best.
Amazing. I mean, I just the double think, the new speak of these people, the glaring contradictions, and the fact that, you know, populism used to be obviously the tools that these people applied to say, you know, we're speaking to the masses and all that kind of stuff, and now they've taken this elitist position where we know better than these people, and they're not educated, and then they don't know any of these things. So what we've seen, Jay, obviously, is a rise of right, more right-wing nationalist populism. And it's the currently the biggest threat to their liberal world order. And
that's what she says, yes.
And it's marching forward at incredible pace. So from Trump to, you know, Le Pen now in the leads and the polls in France, to changes happening even in Germany, in Sweden, with Brexit and all these things. What do you think the dynamic is going to be when these sides really start, like, you know, when the nationalists start gaining momentum? What will some of the counter reactions be? Because right now they're just kind of, they're trying to manipulate, you know, these leftist groups to go out and be violent and all this kind of stuff. That will obviously escalate, but I don't think that will be enough. I think that will actually get more people to be antagonistic to these left-wing groups, don't you?
They're going to lose power because the people are going to eventually realize that all of this is not good for most people. Because it's a giant scam, it's a giant Ponzi scheme, it's a giant hypocritical mass of contradictions. There's no way that it can work. I think, you know, since the first interview that you and I did 2 years ago, we were talking about what's going to happen. And I was saying that I don't think ultimately this will work. And the more that we see these people trying to combat this, the more I think they're losing and they're failing, precisely because the whole thing is a giant garbled mess of contradictions and nonsense. I mean, in this woman's article, Putin Populism, the Defense of Liberal Democracy, she says the exact same thing. Anything that you don't like is fascist and it's xenophobic. And if you don't have open borders, you just are afraid of people. This weapon is not going to keep working when people realize that their whole hometown has been completely changed, right? And they start going from first world to third world situations.
Yeah.
Heartwarming, heart fuzzy argument is not going to keep working, and people are not going to care if some communist pope says that that's what you have to do when he lives in a giant palace with a giant wall around it.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, people are going to realize, I think, the hypocrisy here, and so they've overcalculated by believing that everybody is just a complete total retard, and they're not. We're not all retards, and in fact, these people are the retards. They're not that powerful. Now, they may have money and they might have people convinced, you know, to follow their armies or whatever, their mercenaries. But when you go and you read the articles from the CFR and from these think tanks, these people can't make paragraphs without contradicting themselves completely.
Yeah. And I don't think they're aware of it.
They're not that smart.
They're not aware of it, I think. They're just, again, as I said before, I think that they are just so convinced of their superior stance, morally speaking, that they're just trying to smear their enemies. And I mean, that's been one of the biggest weapons. They've morally tried to charge us with being in the wrong, right, all the time. So they continue to push that button. And now it's just resulted in, like, what's the worst you can call someone? Well, it's a Nazi, right? Nazi, racist, you know, homophobe or whatever. But there was this piece out of, I think it was also New York Times, where they revealed that Steve Bannon was apparently reading some Evola. So are they right about some of this stuff?
Well, I mean, it's just preposterous, given the fact that, I mean, what are they going to do? Like, delete everything that was written prior to the 1960s? They might want to actually do that with Kindle and things like that, right? But yeah. I mean, when you get to the end of this woman's piece, she says, "What's the solution? How do we fight this? What do we do?" More of the same, more propaganda, more education, right? So as long as we keep doing what we're doing, we will continue to have victories, because they are worried. They know that they're not winning. And the only arsenal that they have, the only weapon they have, is to continue doing more of the same that's failing. So if we just continue hammering away, they will not win.
What about the Serbian situation that you mentioned before? Whether this now will be applicated on Russia, or maybe even on those national states that decide to rise up and throw off the shackles of the globalists and say, you know what, we've had enough of this open door policy. We've had enough of being economically dictated to or getting your monoculture shoved down our throats, etc. Is that a dynamic that you think that they're going to try to use it? So again, actually, this is very interesting because now we're back at that point again. American foreign policy, who's going to be the military that goes into some of these countries, whether it's Europe or Australia or Canada or even America itself, if they don't control their own the foreign policy? Do you see what I'm saying? The fist of the New World Order, which has been the American military, if they don't control that and have that completely under their own guise, if you will, they wouldn't have that ability anymore, would they?
Right, and that's why I argued that I had good hopes for Trump, because the engine of America, whether we like it or not, is already here. It's what is, right?
Yeah.
And what these globalists in their white papers say is that the dangers are Putin, Trump, Le Pen, these kinds of movements, Brexit, Farage. Now, again, I think a lot of these people in these movements, the heads of them, don't worry about them. Don't get caught up in the drama or the politics of these people, because the establishment could at any point knock down or take down any of these people. Right. And so it's not about those people. It should be about the idea that we have behind a lot of these movements. Right. Which is to ultimately stop the main big enemy of globalism. And if you can convince enough people that it's not in their own best interests, right? We could maybe use that RAND Corporation self-interest model and turn it around and say, actually, globalism is not in your best interests, right? And there's a cabal who wants to enforce this on you. But so the problem is that they have the economic order. They have control of the global banking economic system.
Yeah.
And any country that's an individual group that tries to move or pull out of it, they just threaten with sanctions, and they threaten with this and that, and they'll do false flags and stage stuff and say that you're an aggressor. Well, all of which they'll just make up. So I think that the best hope is just to continue at this point, not putting all of our money, all of our eggs into a political basket. I'm not saying don't fight on the political sphere, but remember that just having a Brexit vote or just having a Trump or something like this is not the end of the battle. It's just sort
of part of the
one beginning little skirmish where we've kind of won a little bit.
Yeah.
And then there's this giant horde of orcs behind them. You know what I mean? Like Lord of the Rings or something.
Of course. Yeah, exactly. No, you're right. I think that's a good assessment of the situation. And obviously we can almost rely on them, that if these are the publications coming out of these globalist institutions, if this is one of their main strategies of doing more of the same, that's good for us, because that means, you know, they're going to drive more people out from their ideas of how the world should be run towards a more sane, balanced view, whether that's towards tradition or national sovereignty, just anti-globalism overall. So that is a very encouraging, part of this equation. But again, is there any other thing that you think that we could do? I mean, I think we've managed to shift this kind of fake news kind of issue back on them again. Once again, they try to launch that on the alternative media and say, oh my God, these are lies or whatever. We've managed to change the perceptive very strongly within the alternative media of what they're doing and catch them in their lies. And as they continue to exaggerate, as they continue to propagandize us, that just proves our point further. It's further fuel for us to like, look, this is what they're doing. They actually think that they're going to win doing that strategy. It's not going to work. So I think it bodes well for us. But what do you think?
Well, if we just remember that back in 2008, Cass Sunstein wrote this giant paper called Conspiracy Theories. And what he says in this document, and this was under the Obama administration, he says that they need to practice, on page 13, cognitive infiltration of alternative media, independent media, ultimately nationalist medias, right? Yeah. Cognitively infiltrate them, destroy them from within, interject a lot of fake news. This is what you're seeing now, this psyop of fake news was dreamt up by Cass Sunstein as a psyop. And he talks about it in this famous paper. So if we understand that and we don't allow nonsense and stupid arguments and all this kind of stuff on the inside to destroy the anti-globalist movements, then there's no way they can win, because all they have is lies. All they have is constant fake news. So you're absolutely right. They dreamt up the story of fake news. It's all from Cass Sunstein. Here it is in his paper. You showed his book. They have the psyop against us. We just turn it around on them, point out, as Trump did in the press conference. Very fake news. Very fake.
It's great. It's just, I'm really enjoying seeing them squirm and being exposed and go down. And I think at the same time, obviously, what Cass Sunstein managed to do, which was quite effective, actually, was when he specifically targeted the 9/11 groups.
Right.
And I actually don't know if the government ever officially said, you know, oh, we're going to go in there and we're going to make sure that they break apart and they fight and everything else. My view of that was always, well, he probably dropped that seed to get everyone internally to just start bickering and fighting with each other. And voila, job done. Right. But we don't know. This has been their tactics. And that's why I think we shouldn't focus too much on much of the differences, because I think it plays them into their hands, right? Of us bickering with each other all the time. We know the goal. We know what they're doing. Keep moving forward. Keep focusing on the wins and the positive stuffs, and make sure that we're moving in the right direction. That's my recommendation anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you can't beat a giant juggernaut if you're trying to fight 23 battles at once and a juggernaut. You just have to focus all your forces there.
Yeah. Well, very good, Jay Dyer. This has been a great analysis of this situation. I do want to mention, of course, a little bit about your website. Let me pull that up for our audience here. You do have a book out, so we've talked about before, of course, Esoteric Hollywood. The mm-hmm. book is out. I definitely recommend people to pick up a copy and check out the interview if you didn't already. Jay is writing a lot on his site, a lot of analysis, both of news, but also more occult and esoteric subjects and stuff like this. What do you have in the works, Jay? Is there anything you have upcoming going on that you'd like to let us know about?
Well, I would mention that within the last month and a half since the book has been out, it did reach Amazon's number one spot in the Hollywood and film category. So I got to number one, and I did also cross markets. Now I have over 40 five-star reviews. So the book is very popular with the people who bought it and read it. It's doing very well. And as Henrik said, you can get a signed copy direct from me at my website. It's a lot of fun. 363 pages, 404 footnotes, over 50 sidebars, and it deals with everything. It deals with movies. It deals with, you know, geopolitics, as you said, esoteric stuff. It's all of that, focusing on very popular films, 2001, Kubrick, Eyes Wide Shut, that kind of stuff. So that's what I've been pushing the last, you know, couple months is the book orders, which have been doing very well. And this week, Jay's analysis, we've been doing a lot of geopolitics. We're going to return to some philosophy, and we're going to do Marcus Aurelius. We're going to talk about his meditations and the Stoic philosopher emperor. So that's what I'll be analyzing for paid subscribers at Jay's Analysis this week. And in the near future, I think around April, Jay Wiedner and I will be filming a season and a half of a TV show that we're going to be doing for Gaia, which is on a lot of satellite and cable networks. It's also streaming online. It's where Sean Stone's Buzzsaw is housed. And they're branching out and doing a lot of different content they're trying to do. So what Jay and I are going to do is essentially what you see in my book is going to be in an actual series of 30-minute TV shows. And we're going to be talking about clips, dissecting them. It should be a lot of fun. And as I said, we'll be filming, I think, in April, and then it'll probably be released a few months after that. And the plan is to do actually three seasons.
Wow. Excellent. That's great. Keep us posted about that. That's good news. Definitely looking forward to that. Of course, ladies and gentlemen, in the meantime, go to the website, jaceanalysis.com. Check it out. A lot of writings, a lot of audio and video material there as well, beyond the book, of course. But yeah, always great to have you with us, Jay. Thank you so much for coming on. Keep up the good work, and we'll talk more soon.
Absolutely. And if you would, please get the book from me. It's always better for authors to get it from them, not from Amazon.
That is correct. And then you actually make a little bit of money because they drive down the prices. And as you exactly. said, with Kindle as well, aptly named, they are kindling the book fire, so to speak,
book
with
burning.
That device. It's a book burning, exactly. So get it from the author. You're absolutely right. All right. Well, thank you, Jay. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.